I'm Alan Cockle, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ukraine's leaders have agreed to talk in a bid to end their country's election deadlock. In the presence of a European envoy, outgoing President Leonid Kuchma is meeting with Viktor Yushchenko and Viktor Yanukovych. Both men claim to have won this week's presidential election. Meanwhile, massive demonstrations continue in Kiev in support of Yushchenko, the reformist candidate. Joining us is Yohanan Petrovsky. He's a history professor at Northwestern University in Chicago, and he's in close touch with some of the protesters. Professor Petrovsky, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's hard to get a phone line through to Ukraine today, but I understand you have some emails in front of you.
Yes, people email me all the time their opinions and their feelings about what is going on over there in the streets of Kiev.
Would you read one to us? Give us a sample of what people are saying today.
One is from my father, who wrote me, "What we had here in Kiev during the elections was a rape. The government was a rapist. The people were the victim." This is an excerpt from the letter I received right now from my English teacher, who is a professor at Kiev University. "I hate crowds, you know. They make me sick. But being amongst these immense concentrations of people does give me a very special feeling. Elation, enormous friendliness, goodwill, upsurge of hope, wonder, awe, plus a lot more that you can experience being among these people is a heady mix." Another message from my friend, a literary scholar. "What are we trying to do? We are not trying to cancel the election, the results of the elections. We are trying to make the Supreme Court cancel the results of the elections in the districts where major fraud have taken place."
All of these are from people supporting the opposition candidate Viktor Yushchenko. What are they saying about what might happen if the court does not rule in their favor?
They are planning to demonstrate their stamina. They will be firm. They will defend their rights to protect their freedom and their democratic choices. I believe there might be a clash between those who were brought by the governmental support candidate Yanukovych to Kiev and people in the streets. I don't believe there will be a civil war, but we might expect quite a number of clashes.
Now, Viktor Yushchenko, the opposition candidate, is being portrayed in the West as a liberal reformer. Is he really, do you think? Is he really a Democrat?
Well, Yushchenko is a complex personality, I must admit, but he has expressed many times and proved his commitment to democratic standards, to a balanced approach both to European integration and cooperation with Russia, to Ukrainian national democratic values, and to what I would call a genuine tolerance toward national minorities in Ukraine, which are many.
In your view, Professor, what can the United States and European leaders do to see this conflict resolved?
Well, the United States and European Union are trying to help settle the situation in Ukraine on the basis of legality. They argue for the reconciliation based on the laws of Ukraine. However, Yanukovych, governmentally supported candidate, uses the language of legality while talking to mass media, but bends himself backwards, really, to violate this legality. In this situation, I believe the United States and the European Union should consider openly supporting Yushchenko and acknowledging him as the only person who acts on the basis of legality, for he is the only one who says what he does and does what he says.
That would be a breach of diplomatic protocol. The U.S. and the EU have already gone fairly far in the direction of supporting Yushchenko, or at least asking for these election irregularities to be re-examined.
Right, but we have to understand that Yushchenko language has nothing to do with the conspicuous double talk of the President Kuchma and his Prime Minister Yanukovych. This has to be taken into consideration, I believe.
Professor, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Professor Yohanan Petrovsky is at Northwestern University in Chicago. U.S. authorities patrolling the Iraqi city of Mosul continue to find corpses, many of those of security forces. In the past week, 35 bodies have been discovered in and around the city. A U.S. lieutenant colonel says that continuing threats, intimidation, and murder by insurgents are intended to spread fear. Who are the insurgents? Well, many are Iraqis, some are foreigners, Muslims from other countries eager to take up arms against the United States. Robin Young spoke recently with Neil McFarquhar of the New York Times about the journey, both emotional and physical, of one foreign fighter.
He doesn't want me to tell people his name or where he lives because the Arab government's been throwing anybody who came back into jail. But he was a 32-year-old school teacher working in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon and studying towards a doctorate in history.
What made him decide to be a suicide bomber or a jihadist?
He sort of said there were a number of things that influenced him. One was just the daily diet of death and destruction that he was watching coming from Iraq on the satellite television networks. You know, a lot of civilians being killed, the constant mayhem there. He was influenced by a statement by Zawahiri, the sort of leader of the foreign Mujahideen there, saying there was no need to go to the United States to carry out attacks against the infidel. You can do it here. They're occupying Muslim land. And he went to a local school of jihad, as it were, kind of jihad academy, where they studied the difference between an offensive jihad, which is where you go out to try and convert people in another land, and a defensive jihad, where you're defending land that Muslims control. And he decided that what was happening in Iraq was a legitimate defensive jihad, and so he went to take part.
As you write, the jihadists that you met slipped into Iraq through Syria, and many jihadists were drawn to the fight in Iraq because they could get in, as opposed to Israel.
Yes, and if you talk to sort of diplomats and officials in the area, they think there's all sort of an underground railroad that's helping organize this, because every country has people going. And this man's experience was that he just had to pay a bribe, and I've heard others say the same thing. In this case, he paid $500 to an Iraqi, border smuggler, and he got him across the border. He said the first, most simple route they wanted to take, they couldn't because there were too many patrols, both Syrian and American, so they had to kind of go on a longer route that took 8 hours, and they got lost.
The way you describe it, it sounds like just the most bizarre border crossing, with these birds that lived on the desert floor. I guess they would make noise when the insurgents fell on them.
That's right. They just sort of, they're sleeping in the desert at night, and of course they go across at night, and they are disturbed, obviously, when people come crashing down on top of them, so they make a lot of noise. Every time an American patrol went by, they'd have to hit the deck, and it would send the birds up into the air, and so they thought they were going to be discovered. But he didn't seem to have that much difficulty crossing. And I think it's probably comparable to, people sneaking in Texas or California from Mexico. Some make it and some don't.
Right. Well, then once he did make it and he lived and traveled in safe houses, living there with other jihadists, what was he told? There was a sort of a three-pronged way he was told he could fight the jihad.
Well, first of all, I think it was interesting that in order to travel, and traveling inside Iraq also, when they were moving around, he always said he shaved off his beard and wore, very clean clothes, as they tried to look as clean-cut as possible. And when he got to Baghdad, he said he was in a house with about 15 other mujahideen, some from Libya, some from Egypt, some from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And they said it was very well organized. There was an Iraqi person from the insurgency who sort of was their liaison, and he came to them on one of the first days and said the three ways were either to plant roadside bombs, to shoot at the enemy, or to carry out suicide bombings by driving a vehicle into soldiers. And he volunteered for the third because he didn't really have any experience with the first two. But he said there were a lot of people ahead of him who had also volunteered for suicide operations using vehicles. And he specifically wanted to try and carry out an attack against Americans. He said that he thought it was permissible to kill Iraqis because they were helping the Americans, but he didn't want to do that. He wanted to target Americans.
And they were offered the possibility of buying a kit. The insurgents in Iraq had put together a kit for sale?
None of them were traveling with weapons, so they all had to buy their weapons or get their weapons in Iraq. And this man said that they were offered, if they wanted to fight, a kit for $200 that included an assault rifle, a rocket-propelled grenade, and 10 grenades.
So the insurgents sound, first of all, very organized, but this man sounded conflicted. Why did he leave?
He left because he was there at a time when there was not particularly fierce combat going on in Fallujah where he was. And he was hiding out in a house with about 15 other Arab fighters. He said it was a shifting population of mostly Saudis and Yemenis and some others. But it was the home of a newlywed, and the man who owned the house had packed his new wife off to her mother's and was sort of hiding him in his house. And he was nervous because he had to keep the windows shut all day, and he was afraid the neighbors would denounce him or somebody on the street would denounce him, and that would bring, you know, American bombs down on their head. And he said, you know, basically, we have enough Iraqi fighters. We don't really need you foreigners at the moment. If you want to help the jihad, you should go back to your country and raise money and raise support for us. I know they have something of a mixed reputation in Iraq just because they started showing up there during the war, and so there are some people that don't like them because they thought they were fighting to support Saddam, and people didn't want that, although obviously the old elements of the Ba'ath Party wouldn't feel that way.
What's your sense of how many men your Lebanese would-be jihadists represent?
It's very, very difficult to project the numbers. I mean, obviously, there's a steady stream of them. You hear arrests. You know, four people picked up on the Saudi-Iraqi border, you know, three Kuwaitis picked up in Syria. So there's obviously a constant supply of men that are going there. But, I mean, I don't think it's a huge amount, but I really couldn't put a number on it.
And how does he feel now? I mean, he's back in Lebanon. He's, you know, obviously viewing what's going on in Iraq from afar. How does he feel about his decision to leave?
Well, he says he regrets it because, you know, he was sort of the people that he was with. He's recognized some of their pictures in the newspapers, and they carried out suicide operations, you know, and he comes from a fairly economically depressed area of Lebanon where people don't feel there has a future, and he feels like the people that he was in Iraq with attained a certain amount of, you know, glory, and he was saying that, you know, if you fight jihad and you die as a martyr, you end up in heaven at the highest level of heaven, you know, sitting next to the Prophet Muhammad and Jesus. So it's you can attain the unattainable that way. And he sort of, you know, as he says it, he's come back to a life that is less meaningful than the one he was trying to achieve in Iraq.
In the final analysis, Neil, did you get the sense that this was surely that it wasn't practical, that it didn't work out, and that's why he returned home? Or was this a man who, you know, when it, you know, especially when it comes to the idea of the suicide bomber, did he just not have the stomach for it?
You know, it's hard to tell. I mean, it's probably a little. It's a conversation of one afternoon with a total stranger, and I mean, he was incredibly. You know, he explained himself very well and appeared to be an incredibly rational human being. So, you know, when you talk to a lot of these people, I mean, some of them don't always appear that rational. So on some level, I think he probably took the decision that when he got there and saw what was going on, that it wasn't his fight the way he thought it was, and he didn't belong there. You know, but did he chicken out? I don't know.
Neil McFarquhar, thank you so much for telling us the story.
Okay, anytime.
Just ahead, Rebuilding Iraq. We'll look at what's underway in one neighborhood in Baghdad. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. U.S. Marines are continuing their sweep of Fallujah in an attempt to find insurgents and weapons. Two Marines were killed today as they entered a home in Fallujah. Three others were wounded. U.S. troops stormed the city earlier this month and are now searching it house by house. Once Fallujah is secure, rebuilding can begin. How is the rebuilding effort in Iraq going? Journalist Rob Schultheis covered the wars in Afghanistan from 1984 on for Time magazine, The Washington Post, and other media outlets. He spent the past 6 months with a U.S. Army civil affairs team assigned to one Baghdad neighborhood. He's now writing a book about that experience, and he spoke earlier this week with Robin Young.
Well, what did you do with these reconstruction teams?
Well, civil affairs, they're supposed to bring back life back to normal is basically how you'd put it. And in Iraq, in this one neighborhood called Qadamiyah, it's a really old Shia, traditional Shia neighborhood in western Baghdad. And the neighborhood right around where we were is centered around this amazing shrine. It's the third most sacred place in Shiism. Really beautiful, beautiful place. And so the area right around the shrine is very medieval. And there's like a very amazing-looking old open-air bazaar behind it. And then you get into kind of abandoned industrial areas and block housing. And as you get further away from the shrine, you get into some poorer neighborhoods that are less traditional and stable, like up north. We were trying to do, you know, on one level, very obvious things like fix the sewer system that up in the northern part especially had overflown. There were like rivers and lakes of sewage that were a health problem. And make sure the garbage got, because there was no garbage collection when we got there, and set up trash collection sites. And then we're doing these kind of little things, quote unquote, that fix up the traffic circle parks so people could hang out there and playgrounds for the children. And then on a whole other level, we were setting up like neighborhood democracy. And that was the biggest thing we probably did. We were, had these district advisory councils where people could come and complain about, you know, or tell us what they wanted. And they ended up, all of that ended up in the Baghdad government. So it was a way of actually citizens having power over, you know, their lives politically.
Did it work? Was this successful?
In our neighborhood, I considered we really kind of won the war in our neighborhood. But what was frustrating was that that's one neighborhood. And we had a great team, and we were with a battalion of the 1st Cavalry Division that was really remarkable. I mean, they really interacted well with the Iraqis, and they had Arabic speakers in the battalion. So unlike most of Iraq, we got along really well with the locals, and there was a lot of interaction. Like Iraqis came to the gate and hung out with soldiers and talked about stuff. That's not the rule in Iraq. That was the problem. I mean, if we could have the head of the battalion, Colonel Miyamasu, once said that if he could clone Major Clark, who was the head of our team, he could win the war in Iraq.
What did he do that was so special? What
Major Clark?
Yeah.
Well, he was a nut. I mean, basically, being an ex-special force, he would go into any situation. Like, we would be driving off on a mission, and he would see a big angry mob. Instead of calling for reinforcements or having everyone lock and load their weapons, we would stop, and he'd pile out and go into the middle of the mob and start asking people what the problem was. And he had these kind of innate advantages. He looked like a movie cowboy. He kind of looks like Gene Autry or, you know, Red Ryder or something out of the old Western. And the Iraqis really liked that. And he had this kind of style. I mean, he wasn't afraid. And because he wasn't afraid, he wasn't over-aggressive. You know, he just acted like he belonged there. In fact, he told everyone on the team, this is our neighborhood. Not meaning we run it. It's not like, you know, we're the bosses. But these are our neighbors, these Iraqis are. So whenever we go through the neighborhood, act like we're at home here. And because of that, we actually walked to restaurants and ate sometimes and shopped in the bazaar. And nobody else was doing stuff like that.
Well, Rob, President Bush has repeatedly said, and others in his administration have said, that journalists are missing the good reconstruction stories. Do you think that's true, or do you think yours was rare?
Well, one reason they're missing them is because they're kind of discouraging journalists from going there, and I think they're making a big mistake. It's kind of like the war is being kept a secret from the American people, and it's not, that's not good for the morale of the troops when you're over there and nobody back home even knows your, except your family, knows your, what you're doing.
I know that there are going to be people hearing this and you know, thinking, oh, that's so great. There's some good thing happening. There's a neighborhood that was reconstructed and people embraced it. Do you find yourself thinking, geez, this was the way it was supposed to be?
Yeah, I think the Iraqis people expected when we came in, they'll all tell you that we thought you guys were going to do miracles. I mean, you put men on the moon, you're the United States, and they're very disappointed.
And how about now? Are you optimistic about the future of Iraq?
Well, I'd like to be because I'm going back in March. But I'm not. No, I'm really pessimistic because, again, the situation seems to be just running amok and getting out of control. And our reactions to it, using firepower instead of manpower, are just going to create more enemies. And I'm afraid we're going to end up with a real mass movement against us, which we don't have now. Most of the Iraqi people, I think, are still on our side. But I think day by day, we're going to lose that if we keep on our present course.
The neighborhood that you left, is it still holding up?
Yeah, I got a phone call actually last week from one of our translators. She's about 20 years old, a Shia woman. Oh, we're doing all this good stuff, and please bring us some English tapes so we can practice our English and everything. So, Yeah, I mean, you just really, your heart goes out to the Iraqis that, you know, want to, things to work out and still are believing that we're going to be part of it. So, I hope it does. It is in that one neighborhood, but a neighborhood can't survive, you know, thrive in the middle of a country that falls apart.
Rob Schulteis now writing a book about spending 6 months in Iraq with the U.S. Army Civil Affairs Team. Rob, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thanks.
The book Waging Peace by Rob Schulteis comes out next year. Next week on Here and Now, one school system in Massachusetts wants to boost students' test scores. Its solution? Cutting back on recess. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. Once there were tens of millions of bison roaming the American plains. Then white men arrived, bringing guns, and within a few years, all but a few of the great woolly beasts had been slaughtered. Now, it turns out that wasn't the first big extinction of the bison, or buffalo as we call them. There was another population crash a few thousand years earlier. Saber-toothed tigers and woolly mammoths disappeared around the same time, and those extinctions have also been blamed on the arrival of humans, Native American hunters. But a paper in the journal Science this week has a different take. Alan Cooper, a scientist at Oxford University, blames climate for the first great extinction of the bison. Hello, Dr. Cooper.
G'day.
So let me get this straight. What was the bison situation in North America, say, 50,000 years ago?
The population was actually pretty large. It was expanding right the way up until about 35,000 years ago. We're not sure the absolute size, but in the orders of tens to hundreds of millions.
And these are different species?
Well, they're thought to be different species because, or at least subspecies, because their shape and size changes so dramatically over time and space. But actually, the genetic data doesn't seem to support any real species-level splits. And so we're finding this with a lot of the extinct large animals that we look at, that the people looking at fossils have tended to overinterpret the significance of variation in size and shape.
We'll come back to that genetic data in just a moment. But yep. So this population crashed then about 37,000 years ago, is that right?
About 35,000 years ago, the population seems to go into a very sharp decline. It just gets dramatically smaller right the way up until about 10,000 years ago.
And you're saying it was an ice age that caused it. What's the thinking there?
We were looking at two hypotheses, really, that have been used to explain the extinction of all the large animals, human hunting and climate change. And human hunting, humans are only really, there's only signs of them in great numbers from about 13,000 years onwards. And so it doesn't seem to be human hunting. If the bison start declining 35,000 years ago, there's no humans around at that point to do damage, or certainly very few of them. So the last glacial maximum, which is the height of the ice age, or the depth of the ice age, if you like, because it's very, very cold, is about 21 to 18,000 years ago. And so what we're thinking is that some of the environmental changes that were happening in the run-up to that really cold period were causing environmental change, significant environmental change, enough to really have a serious impact on the population size of the bison and cause them to decrease sharply in terms of size.
So all the bison that were here in the Wild West days were the descendants of the few that survived that time. But how do you know this?
Well, what we've been doing is actually getting ancient DNA from bones of bison.
So you're getting DNA out of bones that are tens of thousands of years old?
Exactly. Under cold conditions, it's quite impressive how DNA will survive under very cold conditions.
And so this DNA somehow tells you about this population crash?
Yes. Well, what we do is look at the DNA from the different bones and compare different individuals to see how genetically different they are. And what we're doing is just looking at time slices from the present day backwards to beyond 60,000 years and looking to see how many different DNA sequences can we see existing in the population during those different time slices. And the number of, or the genetic diversity, if you like, of this DNA gives us an indication of the size of the population that was on the landscape at that time.
Now, apparently not everyone's completely convinced by this. They say, look, the bison survived lots of previous changes in climate, and there is more and more evidence for early arrival of humans in North America. Do you think there could be any role for people in this extinction 35,000 years ago?
Just to rephrase that, there's no real extinction 35,000 years ago, but the population does start declining dramatically, down to about 12,000 years ago, which is when a lot of other species go extinct. The bison, of course, just managed to make it through. Now, we see the first signs that are recognized as humans at the moment in North America about 13,000 years ago onwards. There's some talk, and I'm quite willing to believe there's actually humans on the landscape before this, but certainly if they are there, they're there in very low numbers because they leave almost no archaeological sign. That's why the debate is still going on about whether humans are there at all. With such a low population, it's very hard to believe they could affect the bison populations, which are on the order of, you know, hundreds of millions.
But the die-off, the massive killing in the 1800s, that one was definitely us.
That's definitely the Europeans. Intriguingly, people thought that the surviving bison today, which lack any genetic diversity, they have a very small amount, was due to this European hunting, and certainly it didn't help. But interestingly, if we go back into the Holocene, the last 10,000 years or so, we see that population still did not have much genetic diversity. Basically, so much was lost. More than 95 to 99% of the diversity went by the time the population was 10,000 years ago, by that period of time. We think, in fact, the humans probably did apply the coup de grace to many of the populations, things like mammoth and American lion, ground sloth. But the population had been put in a very vulnerable position by climate change that was already very small and in great danger. And so the humans might have actually caused the final extinction, but the populations are kind of a dead man walking by that stage.
Ellen, beyond a narrow story about bison, what's the importance of this?
Well, I think it gives us a very good indication of what climate change can actually do to populations of animals. We've never really been able to see why these extinctions occur. Other major extinctions occur in the fossil record, going right the way back to the Cambrian. They're big events, and we've never really understood them. So in this situation, we can get the DNA out and look exactly what happens to a population under these conditions. And it's a very disturbing picture as far as the effects of climate change go. If we're trying to understand what global warming is doing now and try and predict what effects it's going to have on the environment, this sort of evidence is really quite disturbing. It suggests we should be much more worried about what the impact is going to be on large mammals and I suspect many other things.
Ellen Cooper, thank you.
Thank you.
Ellen Cooper is at Oxford University in England. His research is published in the journal Science.
Give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
Send us your thoughts, partner. Her email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at H-E-R-E www.now.org. Or give us a call and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live. You're listening to Gene Autry and to Here and Now.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging.
Jurors in California have almost finished rewriting the state's jury instructions for criminal trials in a new language. And the language is English, plain English. Last year, the state rewrote instructions for civil juries. But there's been a 20-year movement across the country to try and use plain English in the courtroom. So why the effort in California now? Robin Young posed that question to Leonard Post, staff reporter for the National Law Journal.
Well, California started from scratch. Most states have been revising their own, and California was forced to start from scratch because one of the counties, Los Angeles County, owned the rights to the jury instructions and threatened to sue the state for copyright infringement.
Well, now, how bad was it? Can you give us an example of some old language versus new language?
Sure. Recollection. The old instruction, failure of recollection is common. Innocent misrecollection is not uncommon. There's a triple negative in there. And the new instruction is people often forget things or make mistakes in what they remember.
Oh, see, that just makes so much more sense.
Well, it's very elegant.
How has this been working in California civil courts, and why is this, far more important, as we know that it is, that these are for the criminal trials?
Well, studies have shown that people have perhaps been executed when they would have been sentenced to life imprisonment because jurors did not understand the mitigation instructions. So it couldn't get more serious than certainly someone dying because they didn't understand an instruction.
Why would this kind of simple language be especially important to judges?
When a juror asks that an instruction be explained, judges are very hesitant to take this legalese and try to make it understandable because an appellate court might say that they misinterpreted the instruction and reverse the case and have to do it over, and there's some embarrassment.
I'm reading an attorney's quote that he feels that the new language, the simpler English, is dumbed down, that it's a little wordy and it's not as elegant or clear as the old language. Is that perhaps because it's a lawyer speaking and they're accustomed to the language?
I think some lawyers like the majesty of things that are complex, and lawyers make their living to a certain extent arguing the meaning of jury instructions. So in that sense, some of them perhaps are too simplistic, and some are perhaps even more confusing in plain English, but far more of them are elegant.
You wrote in an article in the National Law Journal about the civil instructions that have already been changed. As we said, California is working on the criminal. Can you give me an example of that?
Another old instruction is preponderance of the evidence, mean evidence that has more convincing force than that opposed to it. If the evidence is so evenly balanced that you are unable to say that the evidence on either side of the issue preponderates, your finding on that issue must be against the party who has the burden of proving it. Preponderates, it's hard to say. It's certainly hard to understand. And the new instruction is, when I tell you that a party must prove something, I mean that the party must persuade you by the evidence presented in court that what he or she is trying to prove is more likely to be true than not true. This is sometimes referred to as the burden of proof.
Finally. It sounds like the biggest change is that people will actually understand better what they're doing in the courtroom.
I think so. This is happening across the country, and there have hardly been any lay people on committees that are rewriting the instructions. They're being rewritten by lawyers, and judges and other legal professionals, and there was a layperson on the California Criminal Subcommittee who fled after an hour of discussion about the difference in the meaning between willful and intentional. She said, I'm retired. I don't need this in my life, and never came back.
Leonard Post, staff reporter for the National Law Journal. Leonard, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Alan Cockle. It's Here and Now. American voters heard from Osama bin Laden a few weeks ago. In a new video, the terrorist leader told Americans that their security wasn't in the hands of either presidential candidate or in the hands of al-Qaeda. Security, he said, was in the hands of the electorate. The tape also served another purpose, to remind Americans that Osama bin Laden is still a free man. Bin Laden pretty much vanished after September 11, 2001. Reports have him hiding in the rugged border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan, or in Kashmir, or in the cities of Pakistan. Jonathan Randall is a veteran Middle East correspondent who spent a decade trying to meet bin Laden. His new book is called simply Osama, and he spoke recently with Robin Young.
What was the most interesting thing, to start with, that you discovered about Osama bin Laden that maybe we don't know?
I think the most interesting thing was his family. Most people in the world, and certainly most Saudis and most Americans, think of Osama as the quintessential Saudi merchant prince, where in fact the Saudi government took his citizenship away, blocked his money, and they would never have dared do that to a native-born, real, quote-unquote, Saudi. The fact is, his father was an immigrant from the Hadramaut, which is a very poor part of a very poor country called Yemen, which lies to the south of Saudi Arabia. Father, two brothers, walked for 1,000 miles, got to Jeddah, worked hard, and Osama's father became one of the most prominent men in the kingdom. But he was never a real Saudi. And his mother, in some eyes, is not even a legitimate Muslim. Mm. By that, I mean she's an Alawite. The Alawites are a sect, live in the mountains along the Mediterranean Sea in Syria. And she was a very beautiful woman. Osama's father liked pretty ladies, had many wives. But the fact is that the Alawites, in the eyes of the Wahhabi, true blue Sunni Muslims of Saudi Arabia, are not the real thing.
Well, the other factor that informing Osama bin Laden that we know of course, is his role in fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, a member of the Mujahideen. How did that impact him? How did that shape him? And how did that make him, you know, larger than life in the eyes of many Saudis?
In the beginning, he was simply raising money. In the beginning, he went out to see a man named Azam, with whom he worked and later all but replaced. And he was so valuable. He was such a prominent person. He came from such a prized family in Saudi Arabia that he wasn't allowed to get anywhere near Afghanistan, nowhere. So that it took him a long time to get up to speed. The other thing is, Saudi Arabia is an odd country. All countries are odd, you might say. But this is a country that, since the death of the man who founded it, King Ibn Saud, was hungry for a hero. And all of a sudden, the jihad was right. It allowed Saudis to believe in something beyond their shores, to believe in their religion. And for Osama, this was a way of becoming an instant hero. And the Saudi press went along with it. They were hungry to have one of their own being a superhero. And the Saudi press made him into one very quickly. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying he didn't deserve it, but perhaps the feat of arms that he keeps talking about were less exceptional than a more judicious observer would credit him.
One part of the story that you tell that I found fascinating and didn't feel I knew as much about was when Osama bin Laden returned from Afghanistan, a hero in the eyes of many, he predicted that Saddam Hussein, or he felt he predicted that Saddam Hussein was going to invade Kuwait. And then he was furious when the Saudi Arabians chose the Americans as their partner in fighting Saddam Hussein instead of Osama bin Laden and his fighters, which furthers the thinking that Osama bin Laden was no friend of Saddam Hussein.
I think you're quite right. I mean, there was many murky undertakings in the Middle East and elsewhere, all kinds of people talk to all kinds of other people. But the bedrock of Osama's thinking opposed Saddam Hussein. The Ba'ath regime, for its many sins, was very secular, and one thing Osama never was secular. When he came back in 89, he was feted in Medina, Mecca, Jeddah, by very important, very rich Saudis, and he kept saying, watch out for, we've got to watch out for Saddam, he's up to no good. Well, the Saudi royal family didn't want to hear that. Put yourself in the shoes of the royal family. They're running a kingdom, that's a difficult job, it's all not sweetness and light, and their most dangerous and threatening neighbor happens to be Saddam Hussein. The last thing they wanted to do was to have some kid who'd been made into a superhero by the press going around bad-mouthing Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
Do you think if you were to meet him, from what you know about him, that you might, that's an odd question, but that you might be charmed by him?
Oh, yeah, I think, sure. Look, I've... in a long life of interviewing bad guys, Osama's more interesting than most. I mean, he's not just a thug. There's another side to him. Any interviewer with his or her salt is at times charmed as well as repelled by contemporary history's larger-than-life villains or good guys. That said, would that stop you from asking the right questions? I hope not.
Just tell me, what is the one question? I know you have many, but what's the one question you want to ask him?
I want to know when he became anti-American, because I don't know that answer. I went to see a Palestinian friend of mine who I knew from Beirut, who was in the Palestinian resistance in the 70s and 80s. He put me onto a childhood friend in Jordan who was an engineer. He had worked for Osama's father, adored his father, just loved him. Old man bin Laden was illiterate, but he had that. He was a great leader of boys and girls. I mean, he had that ability to energize people. And Osama had worked for him, and he'd show up every day at 5 o'clock in the morning. He was very good. He took orders. His job was to go to the government ministries and smooth out the problems. Many of the engineers who were working for the bin Laden group on that job, the bin Laden organization, were Westerners, and many of the Westerners were Americans. Osama got on beautifully with them. He spoke English with them. He spoke perfect English. There was no indication. We're not talking the late 70s and early 80s. There was no indication of this abiding, what became an abiding hatred for all things Western and especially American. I still do not understand when and how he changed.
When did it turn into such a visceral, murderous hatred? That's what you want to know.
I talked to one person who said that even when Osama was a boy, he had religious instruction from a Sudanese cleric, and that the Sudanese gentleman had told his family, you must be very careful about Osama. There's something quite intolerant about him. But that's a story.
You want to hear it from him.
The rest of it, you know, he got on, as I say, got on beautifully with these Westerners. Mm. And he got on beautifully with a Palestinian engineer who was part of the PFLP. It was a Marxist. So, I mean, go figure.
Well, Jonathan Randall, you have answered all the other questions about Osama bin Laden in your new book. Thanks for talking to us about it.
And thank you so much for thinking of me.
Robin Young spoke with Jonathan Randall about his new book, Osama. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Will Thompson, our newscast producer is Lindsay Cradell, and our interns are Danielle Dreilinger and Jennifer Miller. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Alan Cockle. Robin Young will be back on Monday. So get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.